there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your low-key zine swap of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. That is Vagabond. That is Cold Apartment. It's a big week for the New York Times pop music team. A package that we have been working on for quite a long time. Came out a few days ago. Something that we're all really excited about on women and non-binary led punk outfits and DIY outfits. And I am here with the team. Well, no JP, but I'm here with the rest of the New York Times pop music team. I've got Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter.
I'm here.
I've got Karen Gans, pop music editor.
I'm excited.
I know. You're excited also because you are wearing, I would say, a pretty colorful t-shirt.
I am, for me.
Yes,
so
for
we can
you.
All picture.
For, yes, these are all, remember, all things should be assessed within relative frameworks sometimes. So for Karen.
I'm wearing a purple Whitney Houston shirt that says, "The greatest voice of all."
Right. Now, to be fair, there are a lot of bands who also have great voices in this package.
That's a segue. That's what they call a segue.
Well, I did just watch The Fate of the Furious, so I'm just, there are these hard
this
car
your,
turns.
This is your Tokyo Drift of music,
yes,
news,
it's
and
like
criticism.
A hard turn, so I got good at it just by watching that. Later in the podcast, we're going to be joined by Jen and Liz Pelly to kind of talk about some of the bigger themes that came up in our package and then exist outside of it. I want to talk here about sort of the backstory of what we did and why we chose to do it. It's something we've been talking about for a long time. I know, I feel like, Karen, you've been here a couple years.
2 years.
And I feel like even very early, it's something that's come up. I remember speaking about this with you not long after you came here.
Totally. We would have every time you or John Perellis would review an album by a bunch of guys playing guitars, which we don't do as often as we used to, but sometimes we do. Sometimes we, hey,
sorry.
I still like guys playing guitars.
Oh,
as we know,
speak your truth,
podcast.
Speak your truth.
I've been dared to bring my guitars here. It hasn't happened yet. That's a promise.
Yeah. Okay, so that is a promise. Year-end podcast. Yeah. Karen doing guitar covers of the best songs of the year. Okay,
all right. I'll start working.
Can't
on
wait
that.
To hear her play after, swish swish.
Yes.
After the Ashley Simpson podcast.
Yes,
but
which
we digress.
Is coming. Which is coming.
But anyway, when we'd be having these conversations about men with guitars, inevitably, I would hear you guys when I would listen to the podcast that I wasn't on. You'd be like, you know, I listened. these guys are good, but the most important guitar music being made right now is being made by women. And we joke about it. And I remember one day, I think we were sitting at Joe's desk and I was like, we should make a list of these women. And then Joe, who had a very large hand in steering the package, and I'm very proud of him.
Shouts
to awesome,
Joe.
Awesome package. Said, you know, we really should put together an entire package and we should give these women an opportunity to speak and explain how they develop their aesthetic and the sort of challenges that they've had in the music industry and, you know, below the music industry. A lot of these people are operating just below the mainstream.
Yeah, and I feel like, again, it was sort of, for me, doing the piece in this time served two functions. It's sort of to mark the, I don't want to say the end of an era of kind of like white male indie rock, because obviously that seems to not be going away, much as we maybe are not interested in it, we meaning me. But, you know, it's not so much, but to mark the decline of influence of that and also to acknowledge, like, we seem to be in a really robust moment. And we could have done this package, you know, a year ago or 3 years ago. There, a lot of these bands right. have been in motion for a while.
I was going to say, the implication of the package wasn't like, you know, A, look at all these bands that we discovered, because that was certainly not the point.
No.
And the point wasn't B, this is just happening now. You know, the point was to shine a spotlight on something that's been developing for a very long time that just deserves to be celebrated and get a little more attention.
And that seems, yeah, more important than ever, I think, in this moment when we're on, you know, we have the seventh album from A-list indie band and it's just not landing like it used to. Maybe I think in part because it doesn't feel vital to this sort of fraught time in culture and politics and American society. And, you know, we've seen it across mediums and TV and movies and representation. You know, it's slow going, but it's up, and people are telling stories that weren't the stories that have been traditionally parts of the dominant narratives. And I think that that's coming through in underground music, and that was something we wanted to highlight. But then when we actually sit down to start sketching out the logistics mm-hmm. of it, you know, you have to make sort of some arbitrary decisions where, you know, I think we wanted to keep it relatively recent. I think.
Yeah, we sort of had a focus. I think, loosely speaking, post 2010.
Yeah.
Like loosely. I mean, certainly some people in the package had been putting out music 07, 08, 09. But in
the
terms
main
of,
parts of their career with yeah, this band.
Most kind of influential parts of their career, you know.
We wanted active bands.
Yeah.
And a lot of times bands that had put out music recently and that weren't, you know, in a gap. There were geographic concerns. A lot of these bands are on tour. Hard
for
to
arranging the
track
table,
down.
You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and just in general, like, you know, making contact with these artists mm-hmm. and having their participation, because we wanted them to be a big part of this and for it to largely be in their voice.
And also, like, a decision that we kind of came to pretty early was to do it in a way that really accentuated the music and accentuated the voices of the performers. You know, we worked with a design team here that wanted to do a visual representation, an interactive package that felt DIY in its own way, which is, of course, LOL, it's the New York Times. Like, we get it. Like, obviously.
But still, they did a great job.
Yeah, you know, like, Alicia, that's amazing.
Alicia, shout Umi, out. Antonio, yeah. Megan, Alex, Kevin, who directed some of the video content. Everybody, thank you. Looks so good.
Natalia, yeah. who took the photos.
Natalia yeah. took the photos. We had a big team on this.
Yeah, it was, and it was actually great for us because we don't often get to deploy those sorts of resources, you know.
Not only that, yeah,
week
very
in, week out.
Heavily women-led team. There was one meeting where we were joking. We're like, we should really take a photo of this meeting.
I think I have a photo of it on my phone.
We do have a photo of this meeting, it. But it was basically like eight women and Joe. And I mean, I laughed. I was like, if you put eight women in a room and we come up with a project, you know, it might be about women.
So I mean, like, one of the first steps that we took for this was like convening this roundtable. And Karen, maybe you wanted to talk a little bit about that, what the idea was and how we executed it.
The idea of the roundtable.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because we write a lot and we talk a lot on the podcast. And this is funny because it's a big package with a lot of words and like almost none of them were written by us. It's almost all transcript or Q&A, which I really like about it. But the goal of the roundtable was to sort of have a little referendum on what are the issues that these women want to talk about. So we came in with a couple of ideas of what we thought they might want to talk about. And when we let them lead the conversation themselves, they sort of went in the direction we thought and sometimes not. But we wanted to discuss whether or not they see their art as explicitly or implicitly political. We didn't want to focus on what Sadie from Speedy Ortiz called misogyny porn. But, you know, it's instructive to learn about some of the challenges they faced, you know, in sexism in the industry. We wanted to talk about
distribution of music.
Totally.
The way the internet has affected.
Yeah. Yep.
And how particular the internet is to this particular scene.
Yeah.
And how particular it affects, rather, this scene.
Absolutely. And also how if they feel connected to a scene in a larger sense in the idea that, you know, the internet creates the whole world as your scene, or in a more local sense.
So what we did was, you know, with the help of some publicists and some musicians, we wanted to get as many of these people in the same spot. So we ended up with a group of 8 women from different bands.
At Trans Picos.
And we hosted it at Trans Picos, the venue in Queens, run by Todd P, who, you know, was nice enough to have us there all day. And, you know, we did this conversation. We did one-on-one video interviews. There was some music, some hanging out. It was just a really beautiful gathering.
It was one of the most rewarding things I've ever worked on.
Yeah, I remember just at that time, like, I don't, you know, this may come as a surprise to people who listen and to the people I work with, but, like, I don't quell every day. This is me.
John loves to quell.
I'm just saying, I don't quell every day. But it was an incredibly gratifying thing to be even a small part of, and to be able to watch and to feel just to be in that space, to have helped create the space, and to be in that space was really, really, really powerful.
Part of what was so cool about it was that once we convened them and they were all sitting there together, there was a point where they were just talking to each other and interacting, and it honestly didn't matter if we were there. And towards the end of the roundtable, we had asked them to sort of compliment each other if they had something that they wanted to say about each other. And there's part of this in the interactive, but when they were actually, they directed most of the conversation at each other. They weren't talking at us. But when they were complimenting each other, I was going to cry. It was so moving.
We have some audio that we're going to play of that section of the roundtable. So there are 8 participants. Joe, you want to run them down?
So we had Alex Luciano of Diet Sig, Christina Holliday from Sheer Mag, Leticia Tamko, who sings as Vagabond, Victoria Ruiz of Downtown Boys, Shauna Potter from War on Women, Sophie Allison, who sings as Soccer Mommy, Lindsay Jordan of Snail Mail, and Sadie Dupuy, who sings as Sad 13 and is in the band Speedy Ortiz.
So let's listen to a little bit of their conversation.
Downtown Boys and Sheer Mag within like the same week. This isn't our first show. This is like a different thing. You guys were the first punk bands I ever saw like live. And I started looking into like listening to punk music and learning about feminism after I saw Downtown Boys and then Sheer Mag like right after, and that was actually my introduction into like pretty much politics and punk rock music, so thank you.
I remember that show in DC like so freaking clearly, because wasn't there an age thing too happening? I don't know if people realize this, but Tina has like Tina and Sheer Mag have like actually changed my life, and there's a song called Hard Lovin' that I found out was like about Tina's relationship with her mom, but before we even met, which was at an X-Hex show in New York where Tina's mom was, I had sent that song to my mom and was just like very like, you know, this song is applicable to like fighting for like the working class, like a parent relationship. Like it just is a song about relationships and like power. And I just think that like, you know, we've had like, so I know we have a lot of the same pretty much like beliefs about political beliefs and things like that. We've expressed them differently. And I think that like, you know, you don't do intros during your songs because you don't need them. And like, you don't understand like how powerful like your singing is. And we played the other day at House of Vans, and like all these dudes who like, when we played, they were just kind of like, when Tina was singing, they were like shouting these lyrics like about love and stuff. And I was like, this is like chipping away at like toxic masculinity. And I don't know, like, I feel like this is probably not why you all are doing this interview. But another thing is, when I went on tour with Tina and with Sadie, it's really hard to go on a tour with bands that are doing it like a little bit for their living or mostly for their living. And so Sadie pushing us to do a tour where we were giving the proceeds to Girls Rock, I thought was really important. And she pretty much did all of the work and then invited us to come in. And like, that was, I think, really, really huge. And then like, Shermag like paid us equally to them when we weren't as big of a band as they were. And no one does that. Like, that just doesn't happen. And so what happens is it's really hard for people to get shows that actually have a lot of our bands on it, because we're all trying to make a living. Mm-hmm. And that was like some full communism, like, move. So I think that's a big deal.
You played one of the first shows I saw in New York, at Shea Stadium.
Oh, cool.
I don't remember who else played, but I like just went because I was like trying to find places to go. And I saw you and I was just like, wow, like, people like play this kind of music up here at like a like DIY venue, and like people come out to hear it, and it just seems like such a cooler scene and like so much more accepting. And yeah, I was just making stuff in Bandcamp at the time, and I just thought it was like really cool to like see like other like people more like me playing it, especially like genre wise. So that was super cool.
Yes. I just want to give a shred compliment to Lindsay.
Yeah,
you're
sure.
Like a really incredible guitarist, and every time I saw you play. I didn't even think I saw you after. I saw you play like a video or something, and I'm just always so impressed by like, I think a telling thing about a good guitarist is like not having to show off. You're like so. You can be so understated, and then you go into something so tricky and weird. And like, I don't know how that came from a human brain. So I just really love watching you play and hearing your songs.
You know, I would give some shout out to Alex, actually, because we were talking about media and the press and kind of the narrative that they put on you and the things that they say or comment or whatever. And I think, you know, apart from you like making your art and sharing it, I think it's like really cool how you've like risen above like when people say things about you or just kind of take this higher road. And I think that that's important. You're like humanizing yourself and putting yourself first. And that's important. I feel like that's really important for longevity. And it, to me, at least on where I'm standing, it doesn't seem like you make any like rash rash decisions or like feel even inclined to answer to like negative ish, whereas like I'm always ready to drag someone.
No, when you dragged that guy on that video, I don't even know his name. He's
we're not gonna say it.
I was just put that in the like flip side. I was so just like, oh yes. I was like, I wish I was brave enough to say that kind of thing on the internet when someone like is sassy towards me.
Yeah,
and
I was
like,
trying to have men apologize on video.
That is,
I got sucked in too.
So inspired though. I was just like, that is like, oh, I want to be like that. So that's really cool.
Also, one last, I don't know if I can say the one last, but I just like, you have the best. You have such great songs. Like, seriously, like, we have, me and Ray, just, like, have an archive of your demos in the car.
Oh, I send you the demos. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We cry to them. They're so good. Yeah, first Soccer Mommy's show I saw, I teared up. So good. Okay,
like,
it just needed to be
said. Thank you for playing Warped Tour.
Didn't
you
also
like,
have like Safer Spaces
you
cabling?
Took one for
your
team.
Yeah.
And I went to Warped Tour all the time when I was a teenager. Yeah. But like, I know it's like super misogynist space, and like, I feel like people try and throw out like, you know, we're trying to make a festival that's not just like Warped Tour, and I'm just like, dude, there are people playing Warped Tour that like are trying to make it better.
Yeah.
And like, thank you for like taking power there, because sometimes like we can't always create our own worlds. We have to like just
infiltrate.
Yes.
Those are eight people who are sort of ended up being the central part of the round table, ended up being kind of the central part of the package we put together. But there were a few dozen, almost four dozen other bands that we talked about.
Well, you interviewed two people.
Yes, and the Crutchfields. Let's not forget Katie Crutchfield of Waxahachie and Allison Crutchfield, late of Swearin' and currently of Allison Crutchfield. we did those interviews, but then we wanted to kind of give a sense of the fullness of the movement and the moment that's happening right now. So there were two other groups of artists, some who we reached out to include in the interactive package.
And multimedia, photos, right. Songs, part of the sort of interactive slideshow that you can see online.
And then some that are included on the larger playlist that we did. So all in all, about 50.
Yeah. And, you know, these sorts of decisions, like we have a lot of Google Docs. My desk is a mess of post-it notes and scribbles about this. You know, we went back and forth a lot. There were a lot of bands we wanted to include that didn't make it for various logistical reasons. There are some singers that we love and have covered and will cover that didn't quite fit aesthetically or sort of, you know, they were a little bit removed from this world. So, you know, it's a sampling, I think, of the kind of music we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, it's like a snapshot and also like a jumping off point.
Yes, this was not an attempt to make a definitive list.
It's hard to be.
By any stretch.
Yeah, it's hard to be completist. So, okay, so that sort of gives you a little bit of the framework of the work we've been doing for the last couple of months. We will be back after a brief sponsorship break with Jen and Liz Pelley to talk about some of the bigger themes that we touched on in the package. Karen, thanks for being here.
Thanks, John.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration, so I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
And welcome back to the New York Times podcast, your impeccably distressed black denim jacket, which I am not wearing, of music news and criticism. That's A Wall by Downtown Boys. And I in fact, am not wearing a black denim jacket, but I am surrounded by three people dressed all very, very simpatico, who are all here to talk about a very important subject matter, which is the female non-binary punk and DIY package that came out last week, and hopefully you guys have all seen it and consumed it and listened to all the music. We are here with Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter of the New York Times. Also with me is Jen Pelley, who is an editor at Pitchfork and who, as I mentioned last week, has a new book coming out soon on the Raincoats. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
Yo. And I have Liz Pelley. Hi, Liz.
Hey.
Liz is also a writer, and Liz is the editor of an online publication called The Media. You can figure out what the harumph is blocking out. You can find it on the internets. It's also stitched on the side of her bag if you happen to see her out and about. What's up, Liz?
Chilling.
Okay, so for a little bit of backstory, I remember when you had your radio show.
I did.
I want to start before we get into kind of what we did and the package that we pulled together. Can you talk a little bit about that era, the sort of OG Pelly Twins era?
Yeah.
And, which is when I first became aware of you guys. And I don't think I met you guys until after that. But if talk a little bit about what y'all were doing then and kind of the music that you were gravitating towards and helping to sort of share with the world.
Sure. When I was in college, I was involved with WNYU, which is the NYU radio show. And I did a program called The New Afternoon Show, which was 3.5 hours long each week. So, and there was kind of a rule about not repeating bands. So I had this like...
Within a show or ever.
You weren't supposed to play the same band within like a 6-week period.
Wow.
Something like that. So I had this like incentive to be seeking out new music. And somewhere along the line, I realized that the music I enjoyed playing the most and discovering was a kind of feminist punk that was like poppier. I remember discovering a CD at WNYU by Screaming Females, which kind of opened up my like purview to like stuff that was going on locally and introduced me to Don Giovanni Records, mm-hmm. which introduced me to a band like Shell Shag, which kind of just, yeah, it opened, I think, me and Liz up to this mm-hmm. whole kind of contemporary punk world that was happening locally that we hadn't been aware of before. I think when we thought about punk prior to that, maybe it was more like in a historical sense. So that was really, really a game changer, discovering Screaming Females when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And that was because of the college radio station. And I feel like that was a band we wanted to talk about as being really a kind of formative piece in like the current explosion or of women playing in rock music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Jen was at WNYU and I was living up in Boston and also doing college radio at my college's radio station. And I feel like also, yeah, I did a show featuring local and underground music and would kind of play a mix of underground bands that were coming out of New York at the time and also Boston. And just because of, you know, the nature of people who I was friends with and like local bands that I was becoming aware of at the time was playing a lot of homemade music, home recorded music, demos that people were just putting on the internet and kind of like passing around through music blogs and MySpace and stuff like that.
So this is like mid to late 2000s or?
Mid to late 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, like 2009. I guess,
I started doing college radio in 2009. I feel like maybe it's probably the same for you, but my experiences at that time, like doing college radio and writing a self-published blog, definitely kind of set the foundation for me to when I got hired at Pitchfork in 2011. It was clear to me immediately that I wanted to write about bands that no one else was writing about. And some of those bands were like Screaming Females, White Lung, Swearin, Waxahachie. No one was writing about these bands and it felt like something worth contributing, I guess.
We should listen to a Screaming Female song. Yeah.
Their first album came out in, what, 2005 or something? Or, I don't know.
Albums, but the first record that I heard by them was definitely Power Move.
Yeah,
Power Move in 2009.
Yeah. I actually, this morning, thinking about doing this show is kind of making my own playlist of who, like, you know, the Crutchfield piece was Feminist Punk Elders or something. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of making my own playlist of, like, who I would consider to, like, fall within that scope.
Yeah,
if I was
sure.
thinking about the bands that I listen to now and who I consider to be, like, bands that were kind of, like, informative on my taste when I started, like, doing a radio show or started writing about music or booking bands over the past 10 years. And I put the Screaming Female song Bell on it.
Let's listen to Bell from Screaming Female's Power Move.
You have me.
Okay, so when we were emailing, the three of us, before we all came here today, we talked about Screaming Females as sort of an antecedent for a lot of what ended up in the package that we put together. And when I talked to Katie and Allison for the sort of compliment piece for this, they also identified Screaming Females. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of 05 to 09 Don Giovanni moment and what was so important about what was happening with Screaming Females. And also, in a way, like, that was an interesting time in New York, but it felt like what was happening there was slightly disconnected from some of the other things that were happening in kind of like Todd P. land here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I feel like my interest in Screaming Females at the time, I mean, in 2009, I was like 20 years old. And I remember I was actually an intern at Rolling Stone, and Karen Gans, who works at the New York Times now.
Shouts Karen Gans.
Is the editor.
At Met Patrol. At Met Patrol. Get that follow together. Yeah.
She assigned to me to do a breaking profile of Screaming Females when I was an intern or something. And I remember, you know, so I wrote about them. I had to like think about why they appealed to me. And at the time, I feel like the main kind of feminist punk band that had left an impression on my life was Sleater-Kinney. Mm-hmm. They're my favorite band of all time. And it probably had something to do with my age and not really being exposed to a whole ton of kind of grassroots punk that was going on locally, that Screaming Females blew my mind. And they were around, you know?
I just remember discovering them and having this moment of thinking, oh, this band exists now. You know, they reminded me of a legendary punk band that would have existed decades ago or something. And then I remember getting really into them and playing them on my radio show and playing other Don Giovanni bands on my radio show, and then getting a Last FM message from Joe Steinhardt at Don Giovanni, like, thanking me for playing these bands on my show.
Shouts to Last FM.
Just
2009.
Yeah. At the time, I was young enough and, like Jen said, also kind of disconnected from punk scenes. And at the time, it sort of blew my mind that the person who ran my favorite label, like, found me and thanked me and got in touch with me. And I think that kind of speaks to, like, I don't know, it was kind of like an introduction to a participatory kind of music scene, mm-hmm. where people talk to each other and mm-hmm. we're in community with each other and stuff. Whereas before, I feel like maybe punk and DIY was more something that I had like read about than really been a participant.
I remember we went to a Screaming Female show and someone was like, are you going to stay to see Shell Shag? They're about the best band in the world. So we stayed to see Shell Shag. And then I went to a Shell Shag show a couple weeks later and someone was like, ever heard of Big Eyes? Ever heard of Cheeky? And there were all of these bands in Brooklyn that I hadn't really heard of. And I also would say that if anyone is interested in this kind of like local music scene that was happening in Brooklyn around 2010, Kate Watkins wrote that article for MRR in 2010, remember, called Girl Germs. Mm-hmm. Which was a kind of scene report on what was going on in New York at the time.
It's funny that a lot of the threads that you guys are sort of pulling at here are, I think, the starting point for then what we did. Like, we wanted to sort of take the next wave after this. And I think when you're talking about a participatory music scene and sort of these people connecting online and MySpace and Last.fm and, you know, going back to LiveJournal and then obviously what would follow with Bandcamp and Facebook and, you know, putting show flyers on all sorts of social media and that sort of that the beginnings of those communities. And I think people maybe who also, you know, a lot of the women we've talked to for this piece have similar stories of discovery around that era. And I think that the seeds that were planted then are sort of what bloomed into a lot of the groups we tried to cover in this article.
And in what you were just saying, and Joe, what you were following with, it reminded me, Liz, of a lot of the stuff that a lot of the stories you collected in the P.S. Eliot oral history, which is this exhaustive telling of the P.S. Eliot story, which is Katie and Allison Crutchfield's second band after the first band, but before the current situations. But it reminds me of a bunch of the first kind of 10 pages of that, where you have them sort of like beginning this discovery process.
Yeah, there was a sentence in the intro that I wanted to read, if it was okay with you, Liz, where you say like their story is one of Southern teen feminist outsiders coming into their own personal politics, learning to speak out, leaving their hometown and finding their community. It's a story of how all ages community art spaces can open doors for young people, how male-dominated hardcore scenes can be truly oppressive, but finding it within yourself to push back can be life-changing. And I think that applies to some snaps that for that. But I think that applies to everybody. I think that one of the things that sort of draws together all of the different acts that we wrote about in this is that could apply. Maybe not all from the South, but many of them from the South, and sort of found their own communities both in real life DIY spaces and also online.
In that moment of the late 2000s, when screaming females were basically sparking imaginations from the people who were sitting at this table and also a lot of the folks that we spoke to, it did feel different from some of the other Brooklyn warehouse stuff, and maybe like, say, the Vivian Girls universe or whatever. And I wonder why one was more impactful than the other.
Well, I think Vivian Girls actually came from the same scene as Screaming Females, and they were playing different shows because they lived in Brooklyn. But Vivian Girls, most of the people from that band were from New Jersey and had been in the New Brunswick punk scene, which is the same punk scene that Screaming Females came from. And I mean, it's interesting when we talk about starting points, because I think something that's really important to mention is that these are all personal starting points. Like, discovering Screaming Females was my personal starting point, but I don't think that there was ever a moment when there weren't, like, there hasn't been a moment when women haven't been playing rock music. And so, like, everyone needs that band that kind of like lights up their imagination, makes them think of like what is possible for them, for themselves, and like the people around them. But when we look at like the early 2000s, the late 2000s, I don't know if it's, it seems like there have always been really exciting bands playing, and there have been times when the press catches on and pays attention, and there have been times when the press doesn't.
Drag us, it's cool.
Well, I think like that's why, for me, like writing oral histories such as the P.S. Eliot one felt important, and I feel like there need to be oral histories like that written about a lot of other bands that existed during that time and before and after that, because you have these artists who have these like rich histories of pushing open space for themselves and the people in their community, and talking about who they were inspired by and who they then inspired after them. But so often those histories aren't written if they don't, catch like this bit of media attention or something. And, there's a lot of these examples of artists that existed and were building communities, but their stories never really got told in a big way. Or something. So yeah, I liked what you said about starting points, because I feel like the story has been ongoing and has always existed. It's just when people are and aren't finding it for whatever reasons.
I'm looking at in front of me, like the New York Times Women in Punk article from 1980, and also a Sunday Times story from London about called Girls, 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 that was all about women in punk at that time too. So I feel like it's a story that's ongoing since the beginning of punk, like since 1977 when the Slits formed. There have been times when there have been women playing rock music and people have noticed, and there have been times when they haven't, people haven't noticed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, if a band like Grass Widow existed in 2017, that's a band that we talk about a lot because Grass Widow are so good. Shouts out Grass Widow. Mm-hmm. Actually, we would like to do some shouts for bands that were omissions from the New York Times story.
Sure. Can we also, you want to play a couple songs as well?
Oh, yeah. Grass Widow.
All right. What Grass Widow?
Disappearing Industries.
I was going to say we just did To Wear, because that's kind of like,
that's cool.
From the record.
Which one?
Earlier record. It's called To Wear.
To Wear?
Yeah.
All right. Grass Widow, To
Any
Wear.
Any Grass Widow song.
It's a 30-minute Grass Widow mega mix.
He's going to.
I don't mean to like downplay the importance of what was happening in like Brooklyn and New Jersey in 2008 to 2010 and how formative that was for a lot of people who are now playing music and stuff. But when you think about the bigger picture before that and after that, it's like, I don't know, we were, before we came into this conversation, we were thinking a lot about like, you know, well, how do we talk about how we got into this moment or whatever? But like to us, it feels like a conversation that has always been happening. And it's more interesting to think about like, how did the New York Times come to this conversation in 2017? Because there have always been women playing rock music and women playing punk music. It just happens that like sometimes it ebbs into these moments where the media picks up on it and sometimes it doesn't. And for the periods in time where the media doesn't catch on, there's a lot of like
stuff that gets lost.
Stuff that gets lost and like histories mm-hmm. that then people like need to write themselves, and in order for later down the line people to like really appreciate and celebrate the artists of the present, like while understanding them in a historical context. So
I think two things. One, a quick shout out to John Rockwell, who wrote this 1980 piece and who I met once in the waiting room of a doctor's office. And he told me that he used to cover somewhere between 3 to 4 shows a day.
Wow.
A day? Because I was explaining my life and he was like, ah, that's not that
bad. Is this what The Deuce on HBO is about?
He was like, I was at Carnegie Hall at 2 p.m. and I was at CBGB's at 9 p.m. I was like, okay, Flair, like, great. So John Rockwell really out here wow. in these streets. As far as what we decided to do, I think this is a good transition for us to talk about that and then to bring up some of the questions that we had talked about scene. Mm-hmm. So I think probably for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been having these conversations kind of with myself, and then like I'd bring it into a pop music meeting where I was just like, wow, I just really hate most male indie rock. Like they seem parodic. They seem uninspired. I don't enjoy most of what I feel like I've been told I'm supposed to enjoy. And some of that's my own particular aesthetic, my own carve out. But also at the same time, I was like, I'm just so enamored with and preoccupied with so many other bands that are fronted by women. And I feel like that is happening not totally in a vacuum. And I feel like it'd be great if we can find a way to put attention on that. And I feel like we did it sort of in small ways and with reviews and, you know, writing about the Crutchfields early. But in terms of telling a big story, I feel like it's something we've been talking about for a while now. And finally, with the rise of big internet at the New York Times, there was an opportunity to have some resources put into it, and we decided to kind of go for it. The timing was, I feel like it probably, for us, it probably could have been any time in the last 12 months. It just sort of happened now. Joe?
Liz, I think you're totally right that, like, you could do a version of this story at any moment. And one of the things I liked and that was important to us all along was to make sure this was mostly in the voice of the artists and not our own sort of editorializing about it. Obviously, you know, we made selections and we set it up. But, you know, the biggest part of this was a roundtable conversation. And I think the things that came out of having that talk and that I liked about it was that a lot of the things said do apply through eras. They're sort of universal and timeless. And yet there are also things about it that are really particular to this moment. And I think, you know, you see that in distribution of music, in, you know, the communities of Bandcamp, like, you know, it was pretty much unanimous, you know, in the talk that a lot of these women said, you know, I wouldn't be making music without Bandcamp, or I wouldn't have anywhere to put it out, which was, you know, interesting. And then, as John said, like, I think there are moments in time when just men, as considered the default for a rock band, like they're just taking up a lot of air in the room. And there's something about this particular moment politically and socially and culturally, I think, where we've sort of, as music fans, a lot of people, I think, have decided like enough, like with mm-hmm. these canon narratives that have been forced down our throat since, you know, the beginning of rock music.
Recorded music.
I feel like for us as music fans, it's been like the central conversation of our adult lives, right. Honestly. So it's nice that the New York Times is like join us at the table for the conversation about
there was no way to not have the belly twins in this conversation.
And like, I think, you know, you saw
zero chance.
NPR, so. You know, led by Ann Powers, did this thing this summer, the 150 best albums by women. And, you know, Ann Powers in her opening essay sort of makes the same case, which is, you know, this isn't new, but you can't remake history and canons without sort of
taking stands.
Yeah, making big statements.
And giving space.
Even if it's not the only time that could have been done, you know?
True. I really appreciate the representation of the round table, but I feel like the main conversation I've been having, or a main conversation I've been having with people about it, is that, one, the idea of a Woman in Rock article in 2017 is incredibly old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. Two, the questions that were in the roundtable and also in some of the interviews do feel a little bit like square one. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that from 2017 onward, we can get off square one and go to square two. Because something that would have been great is if this piece got more into like their music and what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Well, what they're actually saying. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like that's what makes them the best bands today, you know? Like, the piece says women are making the best rock music, but why are women making the best rock music? It's because they're, in my opinion, they have like the most interesting things to say with their music. Like, you could listen to Downtown Boys, Priests, Sheer Mag, mm-hmm. and like they're making the most resonant protest music today, mm-hmm. for one. We were talking about earlier, I feel like the last track on the Sheer Mag album, Say Goodbye to Sophie Scholl, is one of the most moving protest songs I've heard all year. It's like it's about this woman who was killed at age 21 in Germany for distributing anti-war leaflets, you know, Sophie Scholl. It's a beautiful song. The Downtown Boys song, A Wall, kind mm-hmm. of speaks for itself.
Yeah. Or like Priest's Pink White House. Oh, you know, I think,
yeah, consider the options of a binary.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, any of those songs, those are songs that I feel like could and should be resonating in such a bigger way with just a general cultural consciousness in 2017. They're like songs that really speak to the moment that we're in.
To me, those songs tell the story of America in 2017 just as much as anything that is political on the Billboard charts do. And I think that those songs could and should resonate with a broader audience.
One thing that really stuck out to me, and you mentioned this earlier, was how important Bandcamp is to so many of the artists who were featured in the roundtable, and how clearly from the conversation that they were having, Bandcamp is a platform that is part of the story. It's a tool that is very accessible to independent artists, where they actually can directly sell their music and make money, and it can really like help people who are at this DIY stage of their mm-hmm. career as artists.
Bandcamp money is like a phrase that people use. No one uses the phrase Spotify money.
Bandcamp, that's totally. Actually, when is the first rap song called Bandcamp money coming?
As soon as rappers get on Bandcamp.
Yeah, right.
After SoundCloud
shuts down, they're getting that Bandcamp paper.
But I thought it was really interesting that for a story where Bandcamp, clearly this is, it's a story where the platform is part of the story, for it to then go on and include like 8 artists in the roundtable and 25 in the multimedia package, and then have the rest of the story essentially be told by Spotify. Because from my perspective, it kind of seemed like this instance where if an artist isn't on Spotify, they're not part of the story. But I also thought it was, you know, really cool for the artists in it to talk about how Bandcamp has been useful for them.
Some bands that I've gotten into through listening to them on Bandcamp who are not in the story.
Who?
Bring it.
Dyke Drama.
Oh yeah. So Dyke Drama is the singer of Gloss's other project is very good and definitely a
spider in the webs.
Yeah, rock band.
I have to say though, like bringing in a band like War on Women, who I don't know that much about, it was an instance where I was like, I wish this piece dove a little bit more into the music that these people are actually making, their art itself. So there's a little bit more nuance. We actually learn who these women are.
To me, that's like goes back to what you're saying about like square one and square two, is that so often, you know, like women rock musicians get stuck in these situations where when they get interviewed, like all anyone wants to talk about is gender and being a woman in a rock band or something. And like, hopefully in the next Women in Rock article,
which we could help write if you want some women, just hit us up.
That, you know, topics could range beyond gender. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honestly, like when we were talking about how it would just be so interesting to talk about what the songs written by these artists are actually about.
Like the two Crutchfield albums are so good. Like Never Been Wrong from the Wax. Sorry, go on. I'm cutting you off.
You're cutting me off. No, what I was going to say is that I typed to you and said that two of the best songs about fragile male egos were written by Katie and Allison Crutchfield this year, and they're a mile away from the Allison Crutchfield album and Never Been Wrong from the Waxahachie album. And those are two songs I would just like love to see a conversation about what they're singing about, because I think that like really illuminates, you know, the experience of being a woman musician from their perspective. But
yeah,
anyway. Let's listen to Never Been Wrong.
Let's do it. Okay, so as we're sort of coming to a close, I guess one thing that I want to talk about, and we've sort of alluded to it in a couple of the segments, it's impossible to be complete. It's impossible to tell the fullness of a story, even sort of in the internet era where everything is covered kind of like at maximum volume and maximum intensity, or, you know, if you look hard enough, you will find coverage of things that you probably could not have found coverage of 10, 20, certainly 30 years ago. And I think one of the struggles that I think I had, and I imagine Joe had, and JP and Karen also, was kind of like, no matter how sort of wide a net we cast, we're going to miss stuff. You know, no matter what we run, there's going to be parts, things that we wish we had done. And so there's this kind of like incomplete aspect. And that's true of like any journalism, but especially when you're sort of essaying to take on a big picture topic, that's always a frustration. But that's also a frustration that feels different in this media economy than maybe the media economies of decades past. And I know that's something both of you guys have thought about and also like actively engaged with and tried to like sort of like course correct a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a feeling that, at least for me, like if we don't tell these stories, no one else will. A lot of this stuff has fallen through the cracks of history.
Yeah, I think the lack of those histories sort of makes then coming in at this point tough, because it hasn't been, as you say, like it hasn't been properly documented up until this point. So as old hat as it may feel to people who have been paying attention, like it still is news to some people. You know what I mean? Just because it hasn't been documented enough.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why it's... To me, it's important to do this sort of simultaneous celebration of current artists while also engaging in this history telling.
Recovering stories.
Too, yeah. Like while I was thinking of how to even, you know, go about starting to talk about the importance of filling in like some of the holes of that like obfuscation that has happened in terms of like women's contributions to the history of rock and to punk. Like I was thinking about this series that Jess Skolnick did a few years ago called The Forgotten Women of Punk, which I thought was really cool, where like they talked about how, you know, women have always been involved in punk and rock, but when the media spotlight, like hasn't always like been on them, but doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of important stories to tell. And I don't know, just kind of like thinking about how like going forward, there can be these stories that talk about like what's happening now, but also don't accidentally work to like undo the history or something by not telling it.
Exactly. I feel like it's knowing history is really important. That seems like such a simple statement and maybe like a simplification, but there's so much history that has been lost and is only being caught up now. And I think also when we think about the evergreen topic of women in rock, that knowing history also helps us, as I said earlier, like get off square one, like hopefully as stories of bands that kind of set the foundation for the women who were listening to playing rock and punk today come to the light. There will be more of an understanding that people have been asking about sexism and like what it's like to be a woman playing music for 40 years. I have hundreds of pages of interviews in my apartment of male journalists asking women about the sexism that they deal with and what it's like to be a woman playing music. And I really hope that in the next few years from like this moment on, those sorts of questions can be replaced with more nuanced ones, and that people, even if they are not familiar with the idea that women are playing rock music below the surface of the mainstream, that if they see women talking about their music, they'll catch up because they're smart. They're reading the New York Times. They can put it together. I feel like that's where I hope that this kind of combined moment of history catching up, the world catching up to it.
All right, and let's go out with something cleansing. Let's hear War on Women, Second Wave Goodbye. That's this week's show. I want to thank all our guests. I want to thank Karen Gans and Joe Coscarelli. I want to thank Jen Pelly and Liz Pelly. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That is Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, maybe Bandcamp at some point. You never know. Last week, we had a great time with listener questions and the listener mailbag and Citizen Cope. So always feel free to email us at podcast@nytimes.com to talk more about any of these topics. We are here checking the mailbox. So hit us at podcast@nytimes.com. Our producer is the indefatigable Pedro Rosado in here thugging it out from Headstepper Media. We appreciate you. And we will be back next week.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.